Oh, just hoping.
How you doing, Jim?
Welcome today. This is the Energy Utilities Technology and Communications Committee meeting, and we have many of our committee members here. I'm hoping that the rest will come in very soon, because today we have before us a bill that is complex and a relatively new concept. We haven't heard anything like this in our area, and it's very important that you listen attentively so that you understand what the bill is about and the details about it. And so I think that we have a number of people here to testify, and we'd like to get moving as quickly as possible. I'm not certain whether we'll have a vote today. It will all depend on how people feel about whether they're prepared for this at this time. Okay. And so welcome, Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and committee members, and all who are here to learn about this proposal for low-carbon fuels policy. It's Senate File 13. No.
Senator Sharon, you're going to have to move your microphone a little bit closer. We don't want to miss a word.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Well, I'll begin again by saying thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for your willingness to come to a meeting to review and discuss this new policy called the Minnesota Low Carbon Fuels Policy. And thanks to all who are here who will be presenting today the concerns and the issues they might have, or fears that they might have about what this policy is about. As you know, Minnesota's Next Generation Act of 2007 established aggressive targets for Minnesota to reduce statewide greenhouse gases all across all sectors of our economy to at least 15% below 2005 levels by 2015, 30% below 2005 levels by 2025, and at least 80% below by the year 2050. These are very, very far-reaching emission reduction goals, but are necessary to achieve in order for us to effectively impact climate change. During the past few sessions, this committee, especially this committee, has shown aggressive leadership in promoting and passing greenhouse gas emission reductions and policies for the largest emitting sector, which is the electricity sector. New laws such as 25 by 25 renewable energy standard, the demand for efficiency of 1.5% energy and savings goal, and the Sustainable Buildings 2030 law, among others, are essential in helping the state to meet our Next Generation Energy Act goals. However, we cannot meet the state's reduction targets by solely imposing limitations on the electricity sector. The second largest emitting sector of the greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota is the transportation sector. Nearly a quarter of the state's global warming pollutants come from transportation. There are a variety of strategies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector. The low-carbon fuels policy is only one of those. And it's important that we separate that this is speaking only to low-carbon fuels. It is not about emissions or motor vehicle miles traveled. The low-carbon fuel policy achieves its participation in this goal by requiring the fuels that are used by automobiles to be cleaner. In order to effectively reduce carbon emission intensity of fuels, we must evaluate and limit the greenhouse gases that are produced over the whole life cycle of fuel production. The fuel resource extraction, the refining, the distillation, the distribution and storage of fuel, and when the fuel is burned by vehicles. This type of fuel, full life cycle emissions analysis, is called well-to-wheels. So you'll hear that term, well-to-wheels. Now, I'd like to walk you through the language of Senate File 13 and talk about the specifics of the legislation. Section 1, there should be copies of the bill available for people to review.
We have them.
Section 1 of the bill defines important terms, such as carbon intensity and full life cycle. This section also defines responsible party as an entity that refines or produces or blends or imports transportation fuel. This is an important definition, and it differentiates responsible party from renewable transportation fuel producer. That's critical language in the definitions language because persons who create renewable fuels and sell them to a refiner to be blended into the petroleum are not a responsible party. So an ethanol producer that is not a refiner is not a responsible party, as an example. So the first part of it is dealing with definitions. Section 2 of the bill requires responsible parties, as defined in this first section, to reduce the carbon intensity of the fuel it produces or refines, blends, or imports by an aggregate of 10% below 2005 levels again by 2020. And it would begin in the year 2011. Methods are also defined that the responsible party can utilize, but no exclusive method is articulated. Section 2 talks about some of the emission reduction options that would include blending high carbon intensity fuels with low carbon intensity fuels, such as ethanol or other advanced biofuels. Another method is changing production or extraction processes to be more energy efficient. A third option is purchasing low carbon fuel credits created under a system developed later by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. So that section talks about the reduction at 10% beginning in 2011, 1% per year, just 1% per year, and the methods that can be achieved. Subdivision 2 of Section 2 outlines carbon intensity values. These values are assigned to some dominant fuels used in motor vehicles. These carbon intensity values are used nationwide and were created by Argonne National Laboratories, which is a federally funded research facility that is part of the United States Department of Energy. This is important. I want you to note this is important that Argonne National Laboratories, part of the U.S. Department of Energy. This is important because these values are recognized nationally as standards and that they were developed from a disinterested source, meaning they were not funded by a stakeholder in the process. The carbon intensity values show that different types of ethanol are less carbon intensive. If you look at those numbers, you can see that, than a petroleum-based gasoline. Therefore, as I previously mentioned, one way responsible parties could meet the standard would be to blend standard gasoline with higher levels of biofuels, which would lower the overall carbon intensity of that particular batch of fuel. But most important, it should be noted, because it's not apparent when you read these values, that these numbers do not, I want you to look closely, those numbers do not differentiate. This is important for Minnesota. They do not differentiate between traditional and alternative petroleum, such as tar sands. This is intentional on the part of the bill authors. It is an action that gives a break to tar sands that other refineries do not enjoy. Recognizing the importance of tar sands to the Minnesota's energy mix, we are learning from the difficulties presented in the California model, and we are going to create our own version for Minnesota. These values also do not address indirect effects for any of the fuels, but I want you to know that we intend to address indirect impacts, but not just targeting one fuel, but looking at the indirect impacts for all fuels. So discussion about the indirect impacts of one fuel alone out of the context of looking at all. I want you to make sure that you're not confused by that. Subdivision 3 of Section 2 allows responsible parties or renewable fuel producers to produce a different carbon intensity value for any fuel that is blended, imported, or produced if they can show that that fuel is less carbon intensive than the default value that you've just read in the statute. That number becomes the new value for that particular fuel. What's important about this, to sort of interpret that, means that we will accept these standards that are established at a national level, and those will be the standards that people will operate under. But we have an option here for anybody that's creating a biofuel that is going to be blended in. If they can create or demonstrate a lower carbon intensity than the standard at the national level, and they can present data to demonstrate that, then they can lower their carbon intensity value. This has great importance to our renewable energy interests because it really encourages people to create energy, reduce their greenhouse gas emissions in the production of biofuels. And they will then have a product that has higher value because as it becomes lower in their default number, it has more value to the refineries in terms of meeting the overall standard. Subdivision 4 of Section 2 directs the Commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to develop a credit trading system that can be used by renewable fuel producers and responsible parties to achieve the standard. This is one of the ways that we mentioned earlier that the responsible parties can use to meet the standard. Subdivision 5 of Section 2 requires responsible parties to report actions it has taken or plans to comply with the standard beginning in 2011. In 2013, these responsible parties are required to demonstrate achievement of the standard or purchase sufficient credits to comply with the standard. Subdivision 6 in Section 2 of Section 2 is the compliance section. And finally, Subdivision 7 of Section 2 requires the Commissioner of MPCA to adopt the necessary rules to implement and administer the law. Madam Chair and committee members, that is a very brief summary of a bill. I wanted to highlight the fact that a low-carbon fuels policy has been recommended as a necessary and effective greenhouse gas emission reduction tool by Governor Pawlenty's Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, the Governor's Next Generation Energy Board, and is being promoted regionally by the Midwest Governors Association. We are aware that there are other actions that need to be considered for reduction to our emissions, but this is not an either this or either that. It is all. I also want to be clear about our shared interest and intent in this legislation. First of all, our intent is to address the issue of greenhouse gas reduction by addressing transportation fuel, which contributes nearly 25% of the emissions, the second largest contributor. We cannot deny, we cannot avoid that, and we cannot delay addressing this for short-term gains without severe long-term consequences. Second, we do not want to be placed in a reactive position as a state, defending against a policy that's established out west in California or out east that does not understand our state's economy. Nor do we want to be victims to a California policy by letting them set the standard used to define this policy at a national level. And third, I have met with many, if not most, of those groups that you will be hearing from today. We appreciate and welcome the time that they've given us and the feedback and concerns that they will express today because we are committed to listen and to formulate a bill that will minimize, if not mitigate, the adverse impacts that will be expressed today without abandoning our responsibilities to meet the greenhouse gas goals. With me today, and willing to make some additional comments, is Bill Grant, Associate Executive Director of the Isaac Walton League of American of the America Midwest Office, and Don Arnasti, the Director of Forestry Division, Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy.
Welcome. I think we'll take testimony from the two of you before we ask questions. So, Mr. Grant, you'll start.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill Grant, again, for the Isaac Walton League. And Senator Sharon has done a great job of laying out the bill for you and giving you kind of the context for why we're so interested in moving a bill like this year. I wanted to just put our state's climate goals in some context and how this bill fits in to that a little bit. As Senator Sharon reminded you, in 2007, you passed sweeping legislation in a number of areas directed primarily at the electric utility industry, the Next Generation Energy Act, which also included the conservation goals and set very aggressive standards for with the interim benchmark being a 15% reduction by 2015 in statewide carbon emissions. The Renewable Energy Standard was passed that year. And last year, importantly, you passed the Architecture 2030 bill, which addresses new buildings and moving toward lower energy use in the building stock going forward. When we worked on the two provisions of the Next Generation Act and the Renewable Energy Standard 2 years ago, we calculated that the two policies combined got us about a 7% reduction in our statewide climate emissions by the year 2020. And so a little less than half of the 2015 goal that we're trying to achieve. The bill that we've laid before you today, as you will note, the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group estimated about a 36 million ton reduction in greenhouse gases by the year 2020, which would add another 1 or 2% toward meeting the goal, which is significant given all of the actions we think we need to take in order to achieve those standards, and I think now particularly of the other transportation bills that'll be before you this year in the form of the Clean Cars Bill and the Land Use Bill that addresses vehicle miles traveled. So we think that this is very significant. We think that this particular bill fits well with the other two provisions, that they work synergistically together to reduce transportation greenhouse gas emissions, and that failure to act in any of those areas is going to be a little bit like squeezing the balloon on one end. It simply just gets larger on the other end. For example, if you don't control vehicle miles traveled while you're dealing with the efficiency of the automobiles and the carbon content of the fuels, you could see more vehicle miles traveled that would offset those gains that we were receiving in the other two components. So this is, I think, a very important policy for you to consider. A couple of things that I wanted to emphasize that Senator Sharon has already mentioned that are very important. And we see a lot of people here today concerned about the impact to our in-state refinery operations from a bill like this. I want to make it very clear that when we looked at the values that would be used for the carbon intensity values, that we made the deliberate decision not to distinguish the national average of carbon intensity from petroleum products that we know we're receiving in Minnesota, which are largely now based on Canadian crude. If we had decided to move in that direction, just to place this in some context for you, the Minnesota number relative to the national average would need to be at 1.2 or 1.3 rather than the nominal 1 that we have used. So that would clearly have disadvantaged a large share of the gasoline being refined in Minnesota. While we think it's important to reduce emissions from that sector as well, we realized that it was a very significant share of gasoline already entering the state, and made the conscious decision not to uniquely disadvantage that particular fuel source. Another, I think, argument that you'll hear today is in reference to ethanol standards that the legislature has already adopted, but that the federal government has yet to approve a waiver for, speaking now of the E20 mandate in particular. And there, it'll be some time before we know whether the federal government will approve that waiver. I'm told by agency staff that it's not likely that our waiver application will even be complete and ready for EPA to review until 2012 or 2013. And we've heard from refiners and others that if they aren't given the ability to blend at higher rates because the federal government has prevented it by failure to act or denial of the waiver, that if that situation should arise, we are open to including an off-ramp in the bill for that specific purpose. Senator Sharon mentioned the issue of indirect effects, and we are working on language that would direct the agency, in this case the Pollution Control Agency, to study indirect effects, not just from biofuels or one specific source, but from all of the sources that we think are going to contribute to transportation in the state, and to provide advice to you about whether or not any of the values should be changed as a result of that analysis, and that to give you the opportunity then to consider those recommendations and decide whether or not any of the carbon intensity values that are included in the bill should be changed or not. Finally, I wanted to mention that Senator Sharon mentioned that the bill would include a credit trading system. I wanted to explain why we felt the need to do that. We very much hope that the bill will encourage Minnesotans to purchase plug-in hybrid electric vehicles as they become available on the market. But the problem we faced in the bill was that liquid transportation fuels and electricity aren't really fungible products, and we needed some sort of a bridge through a credit trading mechanism to be able to allow electricity to play in this particular respect and to help us lower our overall emissions from the transportation sector, giving us yet another option for meeting compliance with the standard. So with that, Madam Chair, we'd be open to any questions.
Thank you. Is Mr. Arnosti going to testify first also?
Sure.
Okay. Welcome.
Madam Chair, I'll keep it short because you've had quite a bit of testimony. I think it's covered quite a few topics. My name is Don Arnosti, and I work for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. And
Mr. Arnosti, move the microphone up just a little bit so we can hear you right. Better.
Is that a little better?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you very much. Our organization, the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, is particularly focused on sustainable economies and rural communities. And we're working on this legislation because we think it is a driver of innovation in our rural communities and our rural jobs that exist right now in Minnesota's nation-leading biofuels industry. The biofuels industry started in many ways in this country right here in our backyard due to innovative policies and incentives and mandates that the legislature put in place over the years. And that industry has been criticized for some of its legitimate shortcomings in terms of sustainability, land use, water use, and the overall efficiency of that industry. But like any new industry, often it's not as efficient as it might be as time moves on. We believe this piece of legislation will work hand in hand with some of our renewable fuel producers who are already innovating in many different ways to address some of these criticisms in terms of water use and energy use and renewable energy use in that manner. We have here in this state leaders nationwide within the industry who are experimenting with a number of different Senator Rosen was telling me just recently about a microwave system at one of her ethanol plants that is using microwave to provide energy, which can be provided, for example, by wind energy, getting that off of fossil fuels. There's a tremendous opportunity to take this very important rural industry, which employs about 18,000 Minnesotans directly, and help them innovate and implement new energy efficiencies and new policies and new technologies that will move them down the road to address some of the environmental and climate issues that we're concerned about. We think this bill creates that space, creates that mandate, and basically creates the market, requires that these fuels be allowed a space in the market. This is not the only thing that it does, but we do recognize and we do appreciate and do understand the imperative of preserving jobs and creating jobs and creating green, renewable jobs right here at home in this time of difficult economic conditions. We do believe that this policy will be a net positive for Minnesota. We're talking about providing the space and the opportunity for innovations in renewable energy, whether it be through plug-in hybrid electrics that might be powered by wind generation, or whether it's done by some of our liquid fuels that may be coming from our traditional corn ethanol plants, which have the opportunity to innovate and use renewable bioenergy, for example, to power their systems, or the cellulosic ethanol systems, which are coming down the road. We think it gives an opportunity for Minnesota to once again be a leader in this green jobs, green economy that we know will be overtaking our country. And we'd like to position Minnesota at the forefront of that so that our industries and our businesses can create the products that are demanded in this country as time moves on and actually create and apply these systems, which can be exported to some of the other states, nations, and areas of the world that are interested in this. The last thing I'd like to mention before we'd be happy to take some questions is I would like to reiterate the intentional decision that the authors of this legislation made to recognize all fossil fuels equally as part of, and that is found on the third page of this bill, line 3.7. You'll notice that all fossil fuel-based gasoline is given equal value. Therefore, it will not create any kind of incentive whatsoever for any importer or refiner to change where they source their fossil fuels from. If they choose to source it from Canada, they may. If they choose to source it up the Mississippi River from many other domestic or foreign sources, they may. This bill holds neutral any provider of fossil fuels. We are simply trying to look at the overall net carbon emissions, and we're rating all fossil fuels using Argonne National Laboratory figures as one. Thank you very much. We'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have, and thank you for your consideration of the bill.
Thank you. Mr.
Madam Chair, just Graham. One other point that I failed to mention we wanted to cover briefly. That's the question of impact to motorists at the pump. As you know, there are many factors that drive world oil prices that end up affecting us with at sometimes seemingly crazy swings in the price of petroleum products or other products that we're purchasing to power our vehicles. We don't believe, based on the limited analysis that we've been able to do, that application of this standard will have a significant effect on prices at the pump. There are times when ethanol prices are lower than traditional gasoline, and times when gasoline is cheaper than ethanol. We don't expect that this is going to have a significant effect over time on consumer prices.
Okay. And all three of you now have made reference to the fact that the fossil fuel has an arbitrary or nominal number of one, and so all fossil fuels are in the same category, and what you're trying to do is to reduce the level of carbon intensity by blends or alternative sources of fuel. taking them all from that one conglomerate level that you identify as one.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. And Mr. Arnasta, you mentioned cellulosic ethanol and various forms of electrical propulsion of vehicles. How far down the road is that?
Madam Chair, if I had a crystal ball that I could answer that exactly, I'd be wealthy because I would be investing appropriately. It has been proven, cellulosic ethanol has been proven in the laboratory. The procedure works. It really comes down to economics. And the difficulty with anybody in these times in projecting when you can build the first pilot plant and bring it out is our very volatile economic system and investment climate. There is a partnership with the Little Falls Ethanol Plant where Muscomo, which is a national developer of cellulosic ethanol, has been waiting in the wings for about 18 months to move forward with a cellulosic ethanol plant with an announced value of 10 million gallons. But they have been very much disrupted by the difficult economic conditions and their inability to raise private capital. So I think one of the major difficulties in forecasting when that comes to market is the unsettled financial system.
Does our continued encouragement of corn ethanol inhibit the production of cellulosic ethanol?
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, this bill does not pick winners or losers.
I realize that, but we have continued this in our state policy, and so I was just wondering if it's a deterrent to cellulosic ethanol moving ahead faster.
Well, Madam Chair, market penetration is an issue in a concentrated industry. Fossil fuels are very concentrated, and the reason I believe the state of Minnesota took unusual measures to provide space for the original growth of the ethanol industry was in order to open markets to alternative fuels. So there is the question of, and that is part of what we're talking about here, we are trying to open a space for lower carbon fuels to be recognized as something important to be brought into the transportation mix. So a policy such as this that would recognize low carbon as one of the public values that's very important to be achieved through our transportation fuels would open a space for a cellulosic ethanol manufacturer to compete against traditional corn ethanol as well as other methods to say we have a highly superior product if you look at the number in there from a carbon performance perspective. Most new innovations and new products that come on the market are very expensive, and the initial plant, the first plant of anything, is usually a more costly product, which often needs to be subsidized.
So at this point, really, the goal is to reduce carbon intensity from 2011 to 2020 by increasing the corn ethanol or the biodiesel or...
Well, Madam Chair, we think actually that there are going to be a variety of strategies employed, and what the bill does is provide incentives for a range of possibilities, and depending on how far down the carbon intensity scale you are, the more of an advantage that you'll have relative to the other fuels. So if you see where corn ethanol is, certainly better than gasoline, but there are improved approaches that we think over time, as they develop, will take a larger and larger share of meeting the standard.
Okay. And so we had a discussion today with the MPCA, and they felt that we were pretty much on target for having our 20% ethanol approved by 2013. Mm-hmm. So if this bill were implemented and we increased and if we moved toward a 20% ethanol content, then we would be, up until 2020, we actually would have our plan for reducing carbon intensity.
Well,
is that correct?
Madam Chair, our best estimate is that the E20 waiver would allow us to achieve the first half of the standard, in other words, roughly 5% toward the 10% goal. So the other way to look at it is that the first 5 or 6 years of meeting the requirement could be the application and compliance with the E20 standard.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Mr. Arnasty.
To that same question, we've had discussions with some of the leading facilities in the ethanol industry who are implementing lower energy systems right now, and they've also been talking with the Argonne National Laboratory that's developed some of these figures, and they tell us the application of some of the technology that's coming online today in ethanol as the corn ethanol industry takes its stepwise approach to transform itself would move their performance to, for instance, 50% of ethanol, of gasoline. So what we're seeing is there are intermediate steps here between straight corn ethanol as originally rolled out in a first-generation plant and cellulosic, which is in some ways the holy grail, which is, you know, in the laboratory and perhaps financially out of reach at the moment in terms of application. There are intermediate steps that are relatively low-cost, off-the-shelf technology that's available today that the ethanol industry, some plants are already applying it. In the absence of these kind of incentives, more of them would move in that direction if this policy would provide a marketplace incentive to buy that fuel.
Are you able to give us a little more detail about some of those alternatives?
Certainly. For example, the Little Falls ethanol plant and the Chippewa Valley ethanol plant both have put in place a gasifier, which is the Little Falls plant has had some technical difficulties. It's been up and down. The Benson plant, the Chippewa Valley ethanol plant, has been ramping up their use. A gasifier is a flexible technology where you can put a variety of generally waste materials produced either by agriculture, forestry, a variety of things that need to be dried and pulverized for the most part. And in a low oxygen environment, this biomass is turned into a synthetic gas, which can be substituted for natural gas in powering any kind of industrial system. So, for example, the Chippewa Valley ethanol plant, when their gasifier is fully permitted and operational, expects that they will be producing 95% of their energy use using corn cobs collected from the same farmers that are growing the same corn that they're putting into their ethanol plant. And they'd only be taking the corn cobs, not the stalks and not the leaves, which would be left in the field for building soil and controlling erosion. That's an example where they are able to reduce their fossil fuel inputs for no additional inputs. They're already growing the corn. They're able to provide themselves with a renewable gas. That type of technology, as I said, is flexible for a variety of inputs. I have observed that gasifier operating with shredded pallets. So they're able to use some waste from industrial processes such as pallets as well. That's one example. We could take more time, but I don't want to take too much of it.
Okay. Senator Rosen, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if it's a question or, but this is directed to Mr. Arnasty. There is cellulosic ethanol being produced, and it's just over the border from my district in Emmitsburg, Iowa.
That's true.
They received close to $150 million from the Department of Energy. The technology is up and running. They'll be producing about 20 million gallons of cellulosic ethanol when they're done, along with corn-based ethanol. So the technology is there.
Yes.
I think that we need to make that very clear.
Yes.
And the reason,
yes,
the
Senator.
Reason why, Mr. Arnasty, that they went to Iowa is because Broyne or Poet said they will never do business in Minnesota again because of the permitting process from the PCA. So they went down to Iowa. Senator Sparks has the same condition. He's had plants that have gone into Iowa, and that's where they're doing business. That's my first thing. I just wanted to make sure that you know the technology is there.
Yes, Madam Chair, I was referring to the state, and you're correct in terms of Iowa. Yes, Senator.
And I do think it's very important to realize that this transformation that we're directing the biofuels industry to go into or go towards needs to be very careful when you're dealing with a 50 million gallon ethanol plant versus a 100 million gallon ethanol plant. Those transformations, their energy needs, the way they do business is completely different. It's a lot easier for a 50 million gallon to be more experimental, to try different things, to use different energy driven opportunities than it is for a 100 million gallon ethanol plant. And that's the direction that the ethanol industry is going. Any new plants that are coming on board, they're going to be larger. You know, that's just how it's going to happen. So I think we need to be very sensitive to not only ethanol, but also in the biodiesel industry, that we don't lump them all together with this technology and making sure that we have the same expectations in that arena.
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Rosen.
Mr. Arnosti.
I acknowledge what you say, that each of these businesses has a different model, and some of them have come online in a very highly leveraged, borrowed money condition, and financially they're in a more fragile condition than some of the older plants that are paid for. I would like to mention a different technology that I'm aware of has been studied intensely in a 100 million gallon plant. That has to do with anaerobic digestion of the stillage. And there are, and again, this is not to kind of demonstrate a whole bunch of options, but there are a variety of technologies, and using the liquid waste of a 100 million gallon ethanol plant, that can be put in tanks with bacteria that can produce sufficient gas to not only power the plant, they can cut their use of energy by 30%, they can eliminate added water, just recycle the water and use the water that comes in with the corn kernels, and they can export energy, excess energy, from this kind of anaerobic digestion. So there are different technologies, advanced technologies, that do apply to different scales of plants and different sizes of plants, different financial conditions and ownerships. We certainly recognize that, and we think that this sort of policy will provide a space for that kind of innovation to enter the marketplace.
Mr. Arnosti, you've mentioned You've mentioned that there have been a number of ways to produce ethanol, and yet you've given it one value. And I'm wondering if,
Madam Chair, may I? That's the other portion of what I wanted to speak to. Is that
Senator
there,
Sharon?
Thank you very much. There is in the bill a provision that allows a producer who implements these new technologies to come and to demonstrate that the standard that's established is high and that they should be given a lower value. There is a methodology for any plant that is doing these kinds of activities to come in, or any producer of a fuel product to come in and demonstrate that they should have a different number than the standard that's set nationally. Until they're able to demonstrate, however, the national standard would apply to that fuel.
And
that's a section I refer you to.
Is that in Subdivision 3?
Subdivision 3, yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Arnosti.
I was hoping that I'd be able to bring before the committee today another figure that reflects that, but one of these ethanol plants, the Benson one that has installed that gasifier, informed me a few days ago that the researcher at the Argonne National Laboratory that developed these figures approached them about 18 months ago because they were very interested in the innovation they were doing, gathered the information, and developed a number for that type of procedure. We're not developing these numbers. We're trying to use, you know, science and information that's been brought forward through this national DOE laboratory. And we've been unable in just the last two or three days to bring it forward, but I've been told by the plant producer that that number was about 0.5, which is what I mentioned in my testimony. That's for biomass, gasified, powered corn ethanol. So there's categories that are being defined by these researchers that could be introduced in this legislation. We had hoped perhaps at a later hearing or a later date we could bring that as an amendment and be able to show some of these intermediate steps.
Well, that does raise a question, though. Do you have an amendment for this bill today?
No.
The reason I ask is because you do have some blank spaces in here. Right. And you will, in order to move it ahead, we probably should have some language that satisfies that.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, I guess I was assuming that we would be using this as a meeting to learn about the bill and the bill language. We have been meeting with a number of interested parties from many of the groups that are meeting here have heard concerns, and we have adjustments to mitigate those concerns and amendments that we will be introducing later. So
sure.
We're not prepared to make those authors' amendments today.
Okay. Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a lot of concerns with the bill, but I'll just start with some light overviews just to get you guys warmed up before I get warmed up. It's interesting how you're backing away from a lot of these things already. And in terms of carbon intensity value, when you look at other issues that a lot of labs are dealing with and a lot of organizations are dealing with around the United States, in terms of carbon footprint, water footprint, putting a lot of environmental issues on things, it's very interesting that corn has probably one of the biggest negative impacts in terms of agriculture and what it does to soil, its carbon footprint, its water footprint, alongside of turning that then into ethanol. I'll get into that with more detail on some published peer-reviewed data on that a little bit later. But I guess I thought I'd start out with something Mr. Grant said, that they don't anticipate this type of mandate to have a significant increase in cost to people at the pump, since we already know in terms of dollars and cents that most biofuels don't really compete till gasoline or petroleum-based products are somewhere in the $4 to $5 a gallon range. Maybe you could give me a few examples, any one of you, of a government mandate that created something new that didn't have a significant impact on price, because every mandate I'm aware of has a significant impact on price to the consumer.
Mr. Arnasti, do you want to take a stab
at that? Sure. Madam Chair, I think this state has moved forward with E10, E2, B20, E20 legislation. That was implemented with the variety of price, and some of our surrounding states do not have those mandates, although you can purchase some of those fuels there. I have not observed any significant price differential between the states outside of that which can be recognized in the state tax. So, for example, I go to Wisconsin frequently, and the price of gasoline is slightly higher there because they have a slightly higher state gas tax. I think there are a variety of factors that do enter into the pricing of petroleum fuels, and they've been adequately demonstrated during this past 12 months as we've looked at international speculation, we've looked at global tensions, we've looked at, frankly, supply constrictions, we've looked at hurricanes. There's a variety of reasons and factors that go into the prices. We're not going to pretend that this would not be one of a myriad of factors, but to think that this is a significant driver that overall influences the economy or people's purchasing habits or ability, I think, is a stretch.
Okay. Senator Dibble, was this to this issue?
Yes, Madam Chair. I have an example. I mean, just to say that a government requirement or mandate automatically drives up the price in the market or to consumers is just a statement of belief and not necessarily so. I would point my good friend, Senator Jungbauer, to the Energy Efficiency and Demand Act that we passed a short time ago, which is going to bring the price of energy down. In fact, that's a requirement of that mandate. It's a goal, but it's a mandate in that utility companies would have to satisfy some sharp questioning from the Public Utilities Commission in their resource plans and as they're seeking certificates of need. So there is a pretty strong policy lever to enforce those efficiency goals. That's a mandate in a sense, and that's going to bring the price of energy down, of electricity down for consumers.
Well, you'd have to say the same then about the Architecture 2030 bill, which will also reduce the cost of electricity, or the amount of electricity consumed anyways. Senator Jungbar.
Thank you for those potential examples, although you'd be hard-pressed to find any energy company that would tell you that that's going to lower costs.
I think every energy company will tell you that.
Well, I'm not hearing that from anybody, but you can send them to my office because I'd love to hear that. What I said specifically was a mandate that changes something. And we are changing a formulation of fuel. And every time we have changed a formulation of fuel in Minnesota, we have seen a direct cost factor. Some of them may be small in terms of what you see per gallon price, but a pretty good percentage in terms of percentage. So it has changed things. So I think that's, you know, not accurate to say that you don't think it's going to be a big deal. We've seen a lot of people think it was a big deal to put a new gas tax on in Minnesota, and that wasn't a significant amount in terms of dollars and cents to the average person, but it was significant to the way consumers viewed things. So that was my point.
Okay. Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Senator Sharon or either of the witnesses. As I scan through the bill, I've got this question about the definition of transportation fuel. And my question is, when does a transportation fuel become a transportation fuel? And as an example, I'm just thinking about my Claremont ethanol plant, and they make alcohol, and that's not ready to be a transportation fuel, but they're going to send it out of state. It's going to be blended, and it's going to maybe come back to Minnesota. But it would. I'm just wondering whether or not the net effect of this under this definition just is going to cause all of our fuels, or at least ethanol's biodiesels, to be sent out of state to be reblended and used elsewhere, and we don't get any blending done in Minnesota under this definition.
Well, the question is beyond me. Can one of the gentlemen or Senator Sharon respond?
Madam Chair, I'm just suggesting, ethanol plants make ethanol, alcohol. That's not ready to burn in a car.
And so you're afraid that the definition is too broad and that it brings in...
Well, they're going to have to... Madam Chair, my thought is that they're going to have to ship that ethanol, that alcohol, out of state for blending, and is that going to be the routine? And maybe that's the case already, that we don't blend any of this stuff in Minnesota. But it just seems to me under that definition, this definition, we never will.
Mr. Anasti.
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, I think you're perhaps misreading the bill.
Okay.
The bill is not intended and does not regulate a producer of an additive such as an ethanol or a biodiesel facility that does not directly retail or distribute to retailers the facility or their fuels. So your ethanol plant, which I'll just make some assumptions, I don't know for sure, but your ethanol plant, for example, might be shipping its ethanol to the Ashland refinery or the Flint Hills refinery in the Twin Cities. They are blending in the 10% ethanol required by state law right now, and they may be buying it from your plant. I don't see how your plant presumably is also selling to other facilities in other parts of the country. They could continue to do that.
Okay.
Senator Sharon, under the definitions, which talks about renewable transportation fuel producer, that language was added as a result of concerns as we moved around and talked earlier this summer about being very clear that is not a responsible party.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I believe probably Mr. Grant is the best one to answer this, or actually either of you. I see in the bill it mentions corn ethanol and cellulosic ethanol as being 0.765 and 0.115 for its numbers. And I would imagine that we have a lot of information on corn ethanol, but not so much on cellulosic. And I'm wondering if there's a... Is there a margin of error here? Could the 0.115 go to 3? For instance, you mentioned that there's a 0.5 number for this biomass material. What would be the margin of error here, and how at risk are we of this doubling or tripling?
Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair and Senator Carlson, again, these are values that were taken from this national model produced by the Argonne National Labs. They're taking basically an average of what they're seeing of the types of fuel that would go into making cellulosic ethanol when computing this number. It is an average number. So it's certainly possible that there would be cellulosic fuels given the feedstock that was being used or the process that was being used that could have either a slightly higher or slightly lower number than this. This is an average number intended to be a default value, as the rest of these values are. Again, as we've explained, if a producer were to believe that their fuel or their process were substantially better than the national average that was used to compute these values, he or she would have the opportunity to make that case and receive a lower number as a result.
Madam Chair.
Senator Carlson.
when you're talking about 0.115, it can't get a whole
lot
better.
That's true.
So what I'm wondering is how much worse could it drop to? For instance, if you had more information and didn't have to make quite as many assumptions, or if you had greater data, could it go to 3 easily? Is there a margin of error here that we're talking about?
Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair and Senator Carlson, certainly it could, although we're not suggesting that for the purpose of this standard, moving the numbers around, other than to allow people who feel that they're substantially better than the number to make those adjustments. To allow the numbers to kind of float around would be kind of moving the goalposts for the purpose of this particular standard. Now, I think if the legislature were to find that there were compelling evidence that we got these numbers wrong by several orders of magnitude or whatever standard you'd want to apply, certainly you could come back later and adjust these values. But these are the best, this is the best science that we have available to us right now.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure who addressed this question to, but I wanted to go back to some of the things I think, Mr. Grant, you were talking about with vehicle miles traveled and things like that. And it's just kind of the overall goal we're trying to get to here is to reduce the impact on the environment. And I know that I don't know if I'm saying this right, but the kind of the power of coefficient of a a blend of ethanol is lower than gasoline. So you're not getting as many miles out of there. And I don't know that the engines that we have nowadays are really tuned to really maximize, these blends. So if we don't reduce the vehicle miles traveled and we're not getting as much efficiency out of a gallon of these blends, then we're going to just produce more to burn more. So we're kind of offsetting any of these efficiency gains that by lowering the carbon intensity. How are we going to address that?
Madam Chair and Senator Dahl, well,
Mr. Grant.
A couple of things. First of all, I believe that these numbers include a factor for the differences between them in terms of potential mileage or potential power associated with the various fuels. So I believe that that particular issue is incorporated into the number itself. But the second and more important point is that we really do believe that these policies are best if they're implemented as a suite of policies rather than as standalone policies, that it is important to be improving the efficiency of the vehicles that we're driving at the same time that we're improving the fuels going into those vehicles, and in the same way to act on policies to reduce the need for driving, the demand for driving, by improving our land use policies. So we do believe that these go hand in hand.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grant, to that question about the policies and going hand in hand, actually, you have blending going on out there already, but that is not going to be guaranteed by the automakers on their warranty. So, I mean, we are definitely ahead of the ballgame here with this policy. You have to bring the auto industry along, which they're coming, but we need to get to that point where we can do it succinctly. There was something else that was said by Senator Senjum about the ethanol that's being produced and being refined or blended at the refineries. If we go ahead with something like this and the refineries, it's too cost prohibitive to set up to do this, lower the carbon intensity, and God forbid that they decide to close, actually that could very well hurt the biofuels industry because there are no more options out there. The options are scaled back. And so as we all know, I mean, this whole industry works well when there is competition, it's a business climate. So I'm very nervous about eliminating the options out there for the ethanol or the biodiesel industry. I don't know if you want to respond on that.
Well, very quickly, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I mean, this bill is designed to spur innovation across all of the sectors of the transportation fuel industry. And we have a strong belief that innovation is coming and that we will see these improvements. But I don't think that it's fair to say that if there's a plant that is not able to innovate for whatever reason, cost being one of those reasons perhaps, that they are somehow then disadvantaged by this bill. Because clearly, relative to the goal that we're trying to achieve, any of the biofuels that we might care to talk about here are superior fuels relative to gasoline. So they would continue to have an advantage in the marketplace.
That's, Madam Chair, that's if they have
Senator Rosen.
That's if they have the opportunity to decide where they want to send their ethanol. There is an advantage to be blended, to be refined.
Correct.
My other question, I'm going to
Senator Sharon wants to respond to.
Oh, I think that I want to respond to Senator Rosen because what I heard her saying was that the ethanol or biofuel industry has to have a place to sell their product in order to have the advantage of
blending,
of making all their investments, and that we want to support and promote the biofuel industry. So implied in that, I think, was the suggestion that a policy like this would create a situation where there wouldn't be a place for biofuels to sell their product. Is that, was I understanding that correctly, that the expectation would make it impossible for a refiner to be able to meet the standard and therefore would not continue to function as a refinery? Is that correct?
That's about right, Senator.
Well, I can begin to respond to that. I think that there is some, you know, and I would respect that people might have that fear. But when you really look at what's been happening, we've already passed in this state the E20 expectation. And when the waiver comes, which we expect it will come, we don't know when it will come, and we are willing to look at off-ramps in order to adjust this, to accommodate to that, to make certain that the refineries have the capacity to meet this standard. So without the E20 bill, there may be some difficulty with that. But so we'll have to deal with that in terms of an off-ramp. But even under the E20, which takes us halfway there, under current conditions, the refineries will be making accommodations to expanding the amount of biofuels they use or methods that they use to reduce their carbon intensity.
Senator Rosen. Do we have somebody from the refineries testifying today?
We do.
You can ask them on that technology. That'd be great. My other question to the author or Mr. Grant or Agnasi is the 3.24 preponderance of scientific evidence on the proposing a different value. What does that mean exactly? I know you touched on it a little bit, Mr. Grant, but that I know, and I know Senator Sharon talked about that she was generous to give this Tarzan Fuels a 1.0 rating. And my question is, what does that mean? And also, is there any guarantee in the future that we aren't going to go ahead and just raise that because it's Tarzan oil coming out, and that it's going to be something that the PCA can say, yes, they come to the legislature and say, yes, we're going to raise it, and this is what level it's at because it's from Canada.
Right. Well,
Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair, we actually started in that section of the bill with a clear and convincing evidence standard, which is actually a higher standard legally than preponderance of evidence. And we're certainly flexible on this point of what particular standard the agency would use in determining whether or not the burden of proof on the renewable producer has been met to establish the lower value. In a sense, we're leaving some of that, the details of that, to the agency, but we're certainly open to being more explicit in the bill language itself to, you know, exactly what process would be used for making that showing.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Arnasty.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, In some of our conversations, we've had a suggestion that because of that point that you raised, that about, you know, who's judging and where's the evidence and what's the standard, perhaps one option would be to take the information and run it through the same Argonne National Laboratory GREET model, which is a very public and transparent model available on the web today. And we could reduce the uncertainty by saying that model will be used to derive a new value, and you simply plug in additional information about your new process. And that's been suggested to us, and I think might have merit to help address that question that you raised legitimately, and might be some of the amendments that could be coming forward at a future hearing as a solution to that.
Madam Chair, one more.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. That's so kind. My next question has to do with Subdivision 4 and the credits and the commissioner and the, you know, who's in charge here and how is this going to work and is any other state doing something like this? And it is very, excuse me, but it's a little mumbo-jumbo, and it's very scary. It's very scary to have this bureaucracy building in this bill.
Well, Madam Chair, and Senator Rosen, as I explained before, the reason that we decided to employ a credit trading system was that we were very interested in making sure that electricity as an alternative source of power for the transportation sector could play in this bill alongside with more traditional liquid fuels that have gone into vehicles. We had difficulty imagining, given that they're not interchangeable products, how that would happen without the intermediate bridge of a credit trading system to allow, for example, an electric utility who offers a rebate for a plug-in hybrid vehicle that their customers might purchase would be able to take advantage of creating a credit that they could then sell to one of the responsible parties in this bill to help the responsible party meet compliance with the standard. It would be achieving lower carbon emissions creating greater flexibility for those that are responsible for meeting the standard. How the actual credit trading would work, whether or not those would simply be bilateral transactions between a credit provider and a credit purchaser that wouldn't require any kind of an oversight by the state, certainly is possible, and we've seen that in other credit trading markets. Again, this is the reason that we're moving in this direction. We're reluctant to say that electricity shouldn't have an opportunity to play in this market. Another example would be hydrogen. Again, not a traditional fuel in the transportation market, certainly one that we hope over time becomes available, but we're not sure how to normalize the difference between a liquid fuel and a non-liquid transportation source.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Does California have this system, or is this something that was created just for this Minnesota model?
I actually don't know the answer to that question. Maybe Mr. Arnasti does.
You know,
Mr. Arnasti.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I've been involved right here trying to develop our Minnesota model, and some of my colleagues have actually been in contact with people in other parts of the country. To my knowledge, this is not something that is coming from California, but I'm not certain. We are really trying to put together a policy that we think makes sense here, and we haven't been overly focused on the California policy.
Question.
Okay. Senator Koch and then Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to dovetail a little bit on Senator Rosen's question about, well, first of all, Section 2, Subdivision 3, which is the alternative carbon intensity value. I'm a bit concerned with the softness of that language. I think it kicks the door open for some things to do, particularly with the Canadian crude issue. And I think I've heard 3 or 4 or 5 different times here, no, we're not targeting any different type of crude. We're not trying to increase our dependency on Middle Eastern oil. That's not going to do this. But I would draw your attention to Section 1, Subdivision 5. And this language is concerning to me. It's a definition of full life cycle basis. If indeed we are relying on carbon intensity values from Argonne Labs, I'm wondering, and I looked through the bill, and if I'm missing it, you know, please correct me, but I don't see any reference to full life cycle basis anywhere else in the bill, but I see it defined. And my concern is, if you're using the carbon intensity values as developed by Argonne Labs, what is the purpose of having full life cycle basis defined in Subdivision 5, Section 1?
Madam Chair and Senator Koch, the reason to define it is it is in fact the basis that the Argonne National Lab used. Their analysis is a full life cycle analysis of the fuels that we have.
And Senator Koch, I would direct your attention to line 1.13, where it is used in reference.
In as other definitions. But I'm still not seeing, I understand that that's perhaps what they're using, but I don't understand the need. If we're going to just give everything a 1.0, I think you leave open to interpretation a little more with that definition in there. And I'm not certain if it's necessary. It's necessary if you outline these direct carbon intensity values in numerically in the bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
I understand what's being said, and I think that's something that we could look at as we look at making our amendments to the bill. And I thank you for that.
Okay. Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I'm getting into more details here, and since we have so many people in the crowd that don't know me, I need to do a quick full disclosure of where I'm heading with this with my questions and stuff on the end. And my friend Pat Kessler also told me to disclose that, you know, having reviewed the latest paleoclimatology reports, the Earth is going into a cooling trend, and that cooling trend supposedly is going to last somewhere around 100,000 years. So we might actually, if you believe CO2's warming something, you might want to increase CO2 and everything just to go there. And if your retirement account looks bad, maybe you want to invest in Long Johns. Having said that, I think the United States is going backwards in terms of technology. I think cheap energy has somewhat caused us to not be as innovative as we should be. Okay? Other countries don't have that. They're beating us in the innovation market. They're moving ahead of us. I don't think raising the cost of energy fixes that, but I think we've sat on our laurels, and we need to address that. Lowering emissions, increasing efficiency, that's good for everyone, no matter what you are in terms of conservative, liberal, across the line, it's good for everyone. So I want to disclose that so you know that I'm not opposed to moving in these directions. However, Mr. Grant brought up land use, and I sure hope we all got this book, Growing Cooler. I hope everybody read it. I did read it cover to cover and highlighted it and footnoted it and everything during my nice Christmas vacation. But it talks a lot about land use and carbon footprint, water footprint. And I'm really concerned because though we're soft-soaping some of the things in terms of carbon intensity, if we do not use land use, a recent published peer-reviewed article in Science that I was looking at, I quote, said, by using a worldwide agricultural model to estimate emissions from land use change, the report found that corn-based ethanol nearly doubles greenhouse emissions over 30 years and increases greenhouse gases for 167 years. Biofuels from switchgrass, if grown in the U.S., if grown on U.S. corn land, increase emissions by 50%. So if you're looking at this blending issue and we're not looking at land use, we're actually not accomplishing anything in terms of carbon reduction. And that really bothers me. And this next one, for those people that really know me here, are going to really get blown away, because I agree with the Union of Concerned Scientists. And they said that land use changes need to be calculated because the pollution benefits can be compromised or eliminated with increased production of crop-based fuels. So we can't just look at this possibility of blending things. I think this lower carbon fuel, we need to look at it from a biochemistry end, and we can't just start saying, okay, we can use what we already have out there. We don't have a program. Nobody's done this. We're starting from scratch, and I think we're not doing it the right way. If we really want to lower carbon, then we got to start doing something differently here, and these people have highly addressed the kind of issues that need to be factored in, and they're not even considered in this bill.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The issue that you're raising is how do we address indirect impacts of fuel. In particular, you've targeted or focused on one fuel. What we believe is that the indirect impacts of all fuels need to be fully explored and analyzed and determined, so that when we calculate those into the default numbers, that they are applied for all fuels. So it is not that we as authors do not understand that there are some debates going on about what the indirect land use impact is for ethanol, corn-based ethanol. What we are saying is that we are going to be, as a result of conversations over the summer and looking at this, developing language that addresses that, but addresses it, the indirect impacts of all fuels, and analyzing those, not that they will be equivalent, but making certain that we apply the standard of looking at indirect uses to all fuels.
Madam Chair,
Senator Jungbar.
Senator Chern, if we don't have that in the bill, if we're going to take Argonne Labs' way of setting forth the number, we're going to have to use, and there are some worldwide accepted indirect land use, that needs to be in the bill, or the bill's, quite frankly, not ready for prime time because we don't know where we're going with it.
Mr. Arnasty.
Madam Chair, Senator Jungbar, we do agree that this is a sticky wicket that nobody has resolved, but what for everything that you say about indirect land use effects of corn-based ethanol, which is true, there are some, we need an equal analysis of the indirect land-based effects of the fossil fuel industry, for example. And we can also talk about non-land-based indirect effects. Some of your colleagues here in the legislature like to put out that we are emitting tremendous amounts of carbon in the Middle East right now, protecting our supplies of fossil fuel. Now, that's an indirect effect of the fact that we're addicted to it. But I think it's indisputable that there's a tremendous amount of carbon that is being emitted for that national purpose. How exactly do you calculate that? How much of that factors in? We think that we will be bringing forward an amendment that would describe how this should be evaluated and studied. But I'm not sure that we're even going to be able to solve that right here. And the Argonne National Laboratory has resolved that they are putting those issues to the side while they put forward some factors that allow people, such as you folks, to consider policies that would move us in the right direction, even while the studies and analysis of those unintended consequences and indirect effects continue.
Okay. One more question. We have one of our testifiers that's on a short timeline.
I'll make it very short and sweet. Madam Chair, Mr. Arnasty, is the whole point.
We will have additional time to discuss the bill.
You don't know if it does any good or if we're going backwards without all those consequences factored in. So we can't say that we're moving forward if we don't know everything about that end of it.
And Madam Chair, I think
that's
a principle that we can apply to everything that we're doing. We never really know everything. So if we wait to know everything before we move forward, we'll have to. I only know this, an all-knowing being, as I only know of one.
And we pass many bills where we step in later and we do some corrections.
That's correct.
Senator Dahl, I know you've been waiting to speak. I'm wondering how.
To be sure.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to something you referred to earlier, I know there'll be some increased costs if we go down this road. And you talked about other states that have signed on to agreements that they want to go down this direction, that the MCAG reports has said this is the right way to go. But I also think we shouldn't be, moving forward completely as an island here. What are these other states surrounding us doing? Are they doing anything at all to move in this direction?
Madam Chair and Senator Dahl, actually there's a lot of activity in the states. You may know that Governor Schwarzenegger has issued an executive order directing his state to develop a low-carbon standard.
Madam Chair, Mr. Grant,
just in the Midwest
is all I'm interested in.
various states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Iowa, are all looking at Illinois, all looking at low-carbon fuel policy. They're not to the point of considering legislative language, but they are all evaluating this particular strategy. Combine that with the work that's being done at the Midwest Governors Association on the regional level. There's a fair amount of analysis going on about this particular standard. The advantage of, and I don't want to speak for Senator Sharon, but I know one of her motivations with this bill is to put a marker out there for a state like ours that has really taken the lead on developing its biofuels industries and some of its other alternative transportation industries, and describing what a low-carbon fuel policy would look like from the perspective of a state like ours, so that we can really have a larger role in the debate about this policy as it moves first to the regional level and then to the national level.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And now we would like to move to our testifiers, but you may want to stay close by in case there are questions to answer. And the first speaker is Gary Marr, Minister of the Government of Alberta.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Welcome, Minister Marr.
Thank you very much. For the record, Madam, members of the committee, my name is Gary Marr. I'm a minister counselor in Washington, D.C., representing the government of the province of Alberta, where I previously served for 13 years as a minister of the Crown, or what you would call a cabinet secretary. The Alberta government expresses its interest in SF-13, your bill designed to reduce carbon intensity of transportation fuels. And I can appreciate why some of you may be wondering why a government of Alberta representative would be so interested in low-carbon fuel standard legislation here in the United States. Well, for one, Albertans are the owners of the world's second largest proven oil reserves in the world, and the government of Alberta is responsible for how those resources are developed. Alberta also has been encouraged by state legislators who have visited our province, including your current Speaker of the House, Representative Kelleher, to engage more with U.S. state legislators and not focus simply on the U.S. federal government. Canada is the largest supplier of energy, oil, natural gas, and electricity to the United States. 18% of total U.S. imports of oil come from Canada. And Alberta, on its own, supplies 13% of total U.S. oil imports. That is more than Saudi Arabia, that is more than Venezuela, that is more than Nigeria. Here in your state, a significant amount of your oil and natural gas and related employment and energy security comes from the province of Alberta. With almost 175 billion barrels of oil just 900 miles northwest from where we sit, Alberta offers safe, secure, and environmentally responsible energy for the United States. But with our ability to increase energy production, we are also part of the solution to reducing U.S. reliance upon foreign offshore oil supplies by the United States. Alberta supports policies and carbon management activities that will reduce GHG emissions. Many jurisdictions in North America are pursuing a low-carbon fuel standard as one of many tools to manage carbon and GHG emissions. And we have, for example, been working closely with the state of California as it has moved to try and develop a low-carbon fuel standard. Now, let me preface my comments on SF-13, first of all, with this issue. And I did hear the sponsoring senator, Mr. Grant, and others talk about being clear that this was not to be discriminatory against Canadian oil sands oil, or as some have referred to it, as tar sands oil. Section 526 of the U.S. Energy Independence and Security Act was a piece of legislation that was passed by the Congress, signed into law by President Bush in December of 2007. Throughout the entire time that the piece of legislation was being debated, everybody had always stated that the legislative intent of that section was intended to be about coals to liquids, fuels, and people expressly said that it was never about oil sands oil that came from Canada. And after it was signed into law in December of 2007, in January of 2008, a number of groups came out, including legislators, and said this was actually about stopping oil sands from coming into the United States. So I use that example as a caution that we do want to ensure that the United States does continue to receive oil that emanates from the oil sands in Canada. And so all of my comments are prefaced with that caution that we don't want anything to happen to prohibiting oil sands oil from coming into the U.S. So let me say this. Based on our experience with the state of California and some of the other jurisdictions that we've worked with, SF-13 has the potential to serve as a more reasonable model for other states and perhaps even the U.S. federal government if there are a number of principles that are followed. We feel as a fundamental principle that any LCFS should be designed to manage carbon in a manner that is fair and equitable to all transportation fuel types, and that there should be no discrimination against particular types of transportation fuels. Also, as a principle, the legislation should be open and transparent to all of its participants. And finally, it should be predictable and stable to capital markets, and this is especially important in a time of economic stress. On its face, it appears that some of these approaches are captured in Section 2 of the draft bill. It is important as well that all transportation fuel producers be encouraged to seek improvements that achieve carbon intensity reductions and that these actions count towards meeting regulated fuel intensity levels. And again, Section 2 of the draft bill, as it currently is, makes reference to this ability. The carbon intensity and life cycle definitions in Section 1 are among the more comprehensive, fair, and factual ones that we as an Alberta government have seen. We do feel that it is critical that all fuel types undergo similar science-based carbon intensity assessments. And this is important because these assessments will define the final carbon intensity values. The importance of this approach appears to be captured in Section 1, but some additional clarity that combustion includes emissions caused by burning fuels in vehicles would be helpful. We fully agree with the intent to reduce our collective carbon footprint, and as I said at the outset, LCFS is one tool that can be used to achieve this. However, for a low-carbon fuel standard to be effective, it needs to be honest, fair, scientific, and transparent in its assignment of carbon intensity values. It needs to create a level playing field for all transportation fuels. It must spur innovation, as opposed to being merely a subsidization or a credit trading system that will yield limited environmental benefit. As our closest partner and largest consumer of our energy, we, of course, look to the U.S. as a key market for our goods. We also look to the United States for leadership in addressing global climate change, and to the extent that an LCF standard can help achieve climate goals, Alberta believes that SF-13 may serve as a model for low-carbon fuel standard legislation. Since much discussion was said about the intensity of the oil sands, I will say this in response. The challenge created by oil sands development is that the life cycle GHG emissions from oil sands are between 15 to 20% greater than light conventional oil. It is, however, critical to note that the differential is rapidly changing because of two things. Oil sands producers, for one, have reduced the carbon intensity of their product by an average of 32% and up to as high as 45% because of changes of technology that have taken place over the last 15 years. With ongoing improvements to technology and the implementation of carbon capture and storage, oil sands carbon intensity will continue to be reduced. Our government, the Alberta government, has recognized that we must all reduce our carbon footprint, and in Alberta we have created a $2 billion carbon capture and storage fund to kickstart this significant carbon reduction tool in the process, bring our life cycle emissions in line with and even below other types of crude oil. And for a jurisdiction of just 3.4 million people, that is a lot of money to commit and a big investment. Now, secondly, the world slate of oils is rapidly becoming heavier. The carbon intensity of our oil sands is only about 7% greater than the average basket of crude oil imported into the United States today. As the world's oil supply continues to get heavier, more costly to produce, and more prone to political instability, Canada and Alberta become an ongoing and obvious source of North American energy security. And let me finally say this. As you move forward with this legislation and other strategies that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions, please know that the Alberta government is willing to work with you in any way that we can. And that, Madam Chair, brings an end to my formal remarks. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Minister Councillor Marr. Those are very enlightening remarks. I appreciate your taking the time to come from Washington to speak to us today. Are there, Senator Dibble?
Thank you. I'm wondering, I appreciated the comments. I thought they were helpful as well. I think there continue to be some, I think I sense some concern about making sure that, we have some ongoing specific assurance that we treat all fossil fuels in an even-handed manner. And I think the chief author has articulated her desire to do that and maybe develop some language to that effect. And I'm hoping that you can be available to the chief author, perhaps, to make sure we get that point right in a future hearing where we will entertain amendments. Madam Chair, we can't bind a future legislature. We need to be clear about that, but we can do our best today to address that concern. I think that's a concern that was raised in my office by one particular stakeholder. I think that's it's a fair concern to raise, and I think the chief author has addressed that, and I'm supportive of her intention to address that.
I will be pleased to use my skills as a recovering lawyer to help you with that.
Senator Alcine.
Madam Chair, thank you. Our resident engineer, Senator Carlson, last year on the floor was talking about peak oil and how the world is kind of reaching that point. But one thing I think he talked about was the energy it's taking to extrude the oil sands. And you had alluded to that that technology is getting better. Can you, because he was talking almost, maybe he can correct me, it was almost like 50% energy to produce, it was almost 50% of the energy to produce it. Is that number going to drop, or is that a correct number?
It's already dropped. Overall, you need to know that the world's production of oil ranges somewhere in the 80 to 84 million barrels a day range. The United States consumes 20, 21 million barrels, roughly a quarter of the world's supply. Presently, from Canada, you receive 1.8 million barrels a day. 1.3 million of those barrels a day come from the province of Alberta. Our ability over the next 20 years will be to ramp up that production to being perhaps as high as 4 to 5 million barrels a day. So this is a growing source of energy, and the amount of energy used to produce a barrel of oil out of the oil sands has diminished dramatically because only a small portion of oil sands can you extract by the traditional strip mining process. The majority of the oil sands are so deep that you will not use strip mining, that you will use an in-situ process where what you do is you pump steam into the ground, and the steam causes the bitumen to become more liquid, and it drips into a more traditional type of pipeline, and then you pump it out. And so the amount of intensity of that process is better than the original process of how oil sands was developed. It will continue to get better. And that's why I referenced the fact that the intensity now is up to 45% less energy intensive than when the oil sands first started to come online, in the early 1990s.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Minister Councillor Marr, for your testimony. My question was, you mentioned a little bit about the market and how much how much is the U.S. or the Minnesota market to your oil production, and what are your other markets, the or potential markets that are out there for Alberta and your product?
Minister Councillor?
The Premier of my province has indicated that right now all of our oil from Alberta comes into the United States. It goes through pipelines and goes everywhere. It goes down into Oklahoma, into Texas, into Colorado, Montana. It comes out into the Midwest. But the largest portion of it comes to the American Midwest. Of the 1.3 million barrels a day that comes from Alberta, roughly 800,000 barrels comes to the U.S. Midwest. My premier has further indicated that if there is a prohibition on the United States from taking oil sands oil from Alberta, then there have been proposals to build a pipeline that will take the oil from Alberta to the west coast of British Columbia, where it can be put on tankers and moved elsewhere to other markets.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Minister. Councillor Maher. On that point, you'd mentioned earlier that the thickness, I guess, of the oil, the petroleum, is not much different than what we would get with considered sweet crude. Is that correct? Is that what I was hearing from you? Say Middle East oil. Is there a big difference there? Or, the reason I'm asking is that is if we're trying to lower that carbon footprint and there isn't that big of a differential any longer, then the overall life cost, I guess, of transporting that oil for the Mideast as well is going to negate any effects of trying to go to a different source for our petroleum base. We'd still want to, you know, purchase it from you.
Minister Councillor.
We, of course, would prefer to sell our oil to the United States in a transportation system called a pipeline, a transportation system that doesn't move rather than moving it by tanker, of course. It is very heavy, and a number of refineries in the United States have put forward their capital plans to increase their ability to deal with heavier oil. On a day like today, if we had a barrel of oil and took it outside today and put a hockey stick in it, you wouldn't be able to pull that hockey stick out. That's how thick it is. But through a process of putting distillates in it, that's how you can move it through a pipeline and then get it to refineries here in the Midwest and other parts of the United States as well.
Madam Chair, and if I
Senator
may ask, then
Dahl.
The thickness is about just how it's the form it's in. It's not the process by which we would refine it to in the amount of effort that would be put into refining it to a gasoline. Is that correct?
Once it's refined, it's chemically identical to every other type of finished hydrocarbon product. It is not distinguishable in terms of the molecules that it makes up.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Minister, Councillor Maher, maybe you can help us understand a little bit more about it. You know, we have you as a captive audience here and also an instructor. And what Senator Olsen talked about before, we did talk about last year the ratio. It's the energy in versus energy out. And, you know, just to get everyone's minds around it, back in the 1800s, you could scrape oil off the ground in Pennsylvania. And then a few years later, it would be gushers in Oklahoma. It didn't take very much energy to get that oil, the crude, out of the ground and get it to a pipeline. And I think the numbers that we heard over the years was perhaps 250 barrels out for a barrel of energy in, and then perhaps 100 barrels out to a barrel in. And I think now it's 30 barrels out to a barrel in for the average of domestic oil. And the number that I thought I've heard was for tar sands, it's about 6 barrels out for a barrel of energy in. Now, and I realize that that's going to change a lot based on how you get it where it is and what you have to do to get it out. From what I understand, Canada, and I'll just use the greater Canada, is using a lot of natural gas to either make the steam or to heat the oil. and it comes off of the tar sands, and then it has that consistency, like you said, of I've heard like Vaseline, and now you're using a diluent, a distillate you talked about, to make it so that it can flow in the pipelines. And I'm sure that what's going to happen is it's going to get easier and easier for this oil to be extracted and to be put into a pipeline and come here. Well, I'm wondering, are you using the diluents now to get the crude to Minnesota? And what would be the next stage of that? And I'm going to go. I'll wait for your answer, and then I have a follow-up here.
Okay.
Minister Counsel.
Thank you. I'm not a technical expert, but my understanding is that all the crude oil that comes through the pipelines is thinned out by this type of fluid. As far as the amount of energy that goes into it, I'm not familiar with the number of barrels of oil that it would take to get 6 barrels of oil sands out, because the process uses, as you said, natural gas. So there has been some discussion in the province of Alberta of not using natural gas and using nuclear power instead. That's probably some number of years away. But in the meantime, natural gas, which is not subsidized to the producers who make oil sands, continues to be used in the process of getting the separation of the oil from the sand out. There is still ample amounts of natural gas in the province of Alberta. In fact, 50% of the natural gas exports to the United States, total, come from Alberta. So the issue of the availability of natural gas to continue to do this is not an issue.
Okay. And
Senator now, Carlson.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, that brings up the question to me of this equivalency where we talked about the crude from Canada is the equivalent of a crude from anywhere. Yet in our the improvements that one can make in Section 2 here does have, I've got to find it now, where you can improve the extraction method to, let's say, to meet the standard. Now, if you improve that extraction method, does that change the relationship between crude from Canada and crude from another source, such that Canada could actually be an advantage? Because will you be able to take that information to the commissioner and provide that information that you have improved the ability to extract petroleum from Canada to the degree that Canada will now be a preferential to import crude?
That may be possible. You know, as I've said, over the last 15 years, there's been dramatic improvement. We expect that there will continue to be improvement. And as the RAND report points out, which is a document that I know President Obama has been apprised of, it indicates that when you add carbon capture and storage to it, it will be equivalent or better than conventional oil.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
It is, the answer essentially is yes, that in all fuels are treated the same, that all is the language reads, that any fuel can be proven to be better than the default number.
Madam Chair, any crude you're speaking of?
Any fuel.
Okay, well, we're talking about the total life cycle, so you'd start out at crude.
If Canadian fuel wants to have their fuel, it's like ethanol. Ethanol has a specific number, but not all ethanol products will be treated the same unless an ethanol producer can demonstrate that in their production of ethanol, they're doing better than the standard, and that would apply to all fuels. So in the process, we want to encourage any of the any of the fuels to implement improvements in terms of reducing their carbon, and we want to reward that. We start out with a default number that doesn't discriminate. But it is the individual's actions after that that will allow them, based on their improvements, to improve their default number.
I agree with you about wanting to encourage everybody to improve or to reduce their carbon emissions, but I'm not sure in the situation they're identified as a responsible party and if it would actually lower the value of the product they would be shipping into the United States.
Well,
now maybe the refinery could change it.
The refiner could pursue that.
Okay. I'm not sure the extraction methods is going to change. Are there any further comments? Well, then, Minister Councillor Marr, we really appreciate your time here and the information that you've shared, and we look forward to continuing our relationship with you.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Thank you, members of the committee.
I'd like to now call on Diane Schmidt and Jay Reinhart. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Diane Schmidt, and I am with Coke Companies here today representing Flint Hills Resources, and I have Jay Reinhart with me, who is Director of Operations for Flint Hills Resources, who will be available to answer questions from a technical framework if you have them. First of all, I'm very happy and thankful that we're able to be here today to discuss what we believe is our very serious concerns with Senate File 13. Flint Hills Resources has these serious concerns about the legislation and its implications for Minnesota because we believe that there are no legitimate ways to meet the bill's carbon objective without, number one, increasing fuel prices and destabilizing the state's fuel supply, number two, increasing our dependence on Middle Eastern oil by moving away from higher carbon North American sources, as we've heard, Canadian crude, discovering commercially viable low-carbon alternatives that are based on sound science that do not deplete global food supplies. Very importantly, scaling back production that would jeopardize jobs of those who maintain our region's refining infrastructure. Beyond these concerns, there's still a great deal that we do not know about this policy and how it would affect our fragile economy. There are truly more questions than answers about this legislation. By way of background, Flint Hills operates our Pine Bend refinery in Rosemont, Minnesota. Today, Pine Bend is a world-class refinery and provides most of the Midwest's transportation fuels. About 330 barrels per day is our output. We provide much of the gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel that powers this region. Our refining also produces a variety of heating oils, base oils, asphalt, and sulfur byproducts for fertilizer and agricultural purposes. We are by far the largest purchaser of biofuels as well in the upper Midwest. In your packets we have provided for you, we have some maps that you might also reference. As you can see by the map labeled Western Canadian Crude, and as you've heard in testimony, our crude oil is about 83% from Canada. And so you can see from the concerns you've heard in earlier testimony why we would be very concerned of any limitations that would be put on our ability to use Canadian crude in our process.
Ms. Schmidt, I'm really taking exception to your comments about limiting your ability to use the Canadian crude, since we've already told you that they'll be valued at the same value as any other fuel.
Madam Chair, I'll get further in my testimony, but I can address that right now. We believe that if you look at the definition sections, which I think was referenced by some of the testimony earlier and some of the questions, that if you look at the definition sections, because it talks about the wells-to-wheel analysis, let me get to that section of the statute.
It's Section 5.
Section 5, full life cycle basis, and I think this was also addressed as a concern by others and the author, who hasn't brought an author's amendment to change this yet, has also discussed the concerns about this. When it talks about relating to the full life cycle, including the production and extraction of the feedstock. That clearly hasn't been changed up by any amendment, and we believe that that could also cause concerns. If you look at the full life cycle analysis, and even though you put a 1% in there, that could be changed based on this definition from our lawyer's interpretation. So we think that that would be something that would have to be addressed. Additionally, we believe that when you go into a rulemaking situation or when you have studies that are being done by the MPCA, that there would also be concerns associated with that. And I think also, as we've heard, legislation can be changed. And so even though you would pin this down in a particular legislation right now, there would always be an opportunity for the legislation to be changed. So I think it's important that with the critical nature of Canadian crude, and I'll be happy to continue my testimony, but it's a very important point for us and the stability of our facility that we have spent billions of dollars in infrastructure to build in this economy, that we absolutely have got to guarantee that our stable source of Canadian crude be available for our continued operations and for the vital jobs that we are bringing to the state of Minnesota. And so I'm happy to get back to my testimony, but if I make one point here today, I think it's, and we've made it with the author, we've made it with the proponents, and we've been trying to go around and talk to a variety of groups, it's extremely important that you understand that from our company's perspective, the reason that we are located here, our refinery is located here, is because of our proximity to Canadian crude. It's the reason that this facility was built here. It's the reason that we've been expanding. It's the reason we've invested billions of dollars in that facility. If anything is done in state policy that would do anything to disrupt that, it would have devastating impact in both our ability to continue to improve those facilities or to encourage any additional jobs to do so. So I want to make that point very clear, and that's why we're emphasizing.
And I can appreciate that, and there has been nothing here but an openness to be able to continue that relationship. So I'm still objecting to kind of the scare tactics, because any legislation is open to change. I mean, that's what the legislature is about. So anything could be brought in for change, and we're not suggesting anything than what is right here in front of you at this point.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we are suggesting that the legislation in its current form, we believe, still has some opportunities to bring that in. We're happy to work with the authors and others to try to pin that down because of our very grave concern about what it could do. Additionally, we also find, and I'll go a little off my track because we've got my testimony in writing, but the fact of the matter is there's still other reasons why we believe that this legislation has concerns, because even if you are able to address the Canadian crude portion of this, we also believe that we will have difficulties in finding the alternatives to meet the requirements of the 1% per year. I mean, even if you deal with the issue of Canadian crude, we do not believe that there are sound science alternatives currently in law that will be able to bring us to that point where there's enough degree of certainty to get us to the requirement of 1% a year over 10 years. And so I'm going to continue on with my testimony, but that is another fundamental point. We're not just saying that the Canadian crude point is our only concern with this legislation, and so I will continue on with my comments, but there are several reasons why we have concerns. Kind of getting back to some of my remarks and why we have felt that our investment in this facility is important is we have completed numerous projects over the last several years to invest in this community. For example, just 2 years ago, we completed a $350 million plant to improve our facility. Just to kind of put that into context of the type of investments that we've been making and the kinds of jobs associated with that, that's about the size of building a new twin stadium. So when we're doing projects out at our facility, you know, adding any facilities like that, those are the types of jobs and those are the types of facilities that we're building. This last summer, we acquired two new coker drums, and we would be using going forward to replace that existing equipment, but we have not gone forward and installed those yet. Additionally, in our effort to continue to use Canadian crude, because it's a source of that we use at our refinery, we installed a $300 million new pipeline that we just became operational in September, and that was another one of the investments that we made. And in fact, the Pine Bend Refinery and our ancillary projects like the pipeline has been the largest continuous construction project in the state of Minnesota over the last several years. At any given time, our facility employs between 200 and 2,000 contractors. We also have about an 850 full-time employee workforce, which includes engineers, chemists, plant operators, electricians, nurses, welders, etc. Most importantly, Pine Bend, our facility at the refinery, is very committed to running a very safe and environmentally sound business. We are proud that we have a certified MinStar facility, which we are proud to say was actually brought forward by our own unions, and we applaud them, our own employees, for being forward and for being one of the only facilities that has this very safe workforce. We have over 2 million man hours that have been worked without a reportable injury. We are also one of the 50 largest refineries in the country. We are ranked number 7 for the lowest air emissions per barrel. Last year, our air emissions were 68% lower than the industry average. We have worked very hard to create and maintain the highest environmental standards at our facility. And to be clear, our opposition to Senate File 13 is in no way should be construed as any effort to diminish our commitment to operating an environmentally sound facility. Our position simply reflects our belief that the Minnesota adoption of a California-style low-carbon fuel standard would not lower global greenhouse emissions, but will strain Minnesota's fuel supply and could lead to increased fuel prices. I've already mentioned, so I'll skip by this part of my testimony, but some of the questions that you previously answered about why we believe that there are still opportunities in the legislation that leave it open-ended with respect to Canadian crude, and we can continue to talk with the author about that. Additionally, I think one of our other concerns about the Canadian crude and why we believe that there could be efforts in the future to have that particular language be brought back in is there are a variety of both state and national environmental organizations that if you read their websites and their literature, they have made it one of their primary objectives to actually get a differential treatment of Canadian crude. And so clearly as we go through this, we have to be mindful of the fact that there has been a lot of opposition to the Canadian oil sands in literature and environmental groups across the country. And so one of the reasons we want to make a special point of this is that I think that we want to make sure that there is certainty around this before we go forward with any standard, both at the Minnesota or the national level, that we can guarantee that there will not be a differential treatment of the kind of crude oil that we use in Minnesota in the upper Midwest. If you look at the maps, and I think these have been referred to earlier, is that there is a disproportionate impact in the upper Midwest using Canadian crude versus, say, California or the eastern states. I think California relies about 1% on Canadian crude. The REGI states, which are sort of the eastern states that have gone forward with low-carbon fuels, rely very little on Canadian crude. So you would have a very disproportional impact in the Midwest states, and that's why we have to be careful as you look forward to any Midwest standard or any sort of national standard, that would be something we'd have to look very carefully at. Another thing that we want to mention is I think we've heard people discuss the fact that we have to go on now to transportation fuels because electricity has been the subject of many of your discussions over the last several years. Maybe not in your committee, but in a variety of committees in which I have been participating, we have taken very large strides in Minnesota in transportation fuels. As I know many of you are aware, we have the first ever 20% mandate for ethanol in the state of Minnesota. So from a renewable standpoint, we have on the books in Minnesota the first ever 20% ethanol mandate. We also have the first biodiesel mandate, which has a goal of going up to 20%. Right now we've gone from 2% to 5% with a goal of going up to 20%. So from that standpoint, we have the most aggressive renewable transportation portfolio of any state in the country. So I think one of the things that we want to be careful about here is before we move forward with a low-carbon fuel standard with a lot of open-ended questions, I think we want to make sure that we don't move too quickly when we've already got the most aggressive transportation fuel mandates in the country. Some of the questions earlier were about pricing. And obviously pricing is done on a market basis, and it's always difficult to pin anybody down on precisely what causes market pricing. But we should be very careful whenever we look at changes or mandates or things that get into the marketplace that can cause for differentials between states. We have to look at California, for example. California fuel prices, as we know, have been higher than virtually any other state because of their variable type of fueling. And we have to look at that from the perspective of Minnesota, which has been somewhat blessed to have some lower prices because of our access to Canadian crude, a very stable source, and with the fact that we have two large refiners in our state, and we've not had to deal with the variable supply because we have our good access to our own crude supply from Canada. So when we've had things like hurricanes and other things like that that have taken and disrupted the markets across the country, we have had the benefit of having a stable source from a friendly country. So when we start destabilizing the fuel supply as it's coming into Minnesota and relying on other markets, such as having to rely on fuel coming in from the Middle East, from the Gulf, or doing other things to destabilize it, like worrying about the fact that we're going to have a state-only type of program, a low-carbon fuel standard that's going to just deal with Minnesota. We have to be very careful that doesn't do something that will increase the pricing just for Minnesota. Now, it's hard to say with any assurance how that would happen, but these are the sorts of things that we're going to have to look at as we go forward in any type of policy dealing with low-carbon fuel. Madam Chair, I think my full testimony is in your packets, and you can look at some of the other materials that we've put forward. But I think, needless to say, we have spoken with the author. We understand that she has intentions to continue to keep talking with us, but I think we would be remiss if we did not come before this committee and state the fact that we have some very serious and legitimate concerns, we believe, about this legislation, even if you were able to deal with the fact that Canadian crude would not be somehow treated differentially as any other type of crude supply. We still have to look at the fact that the availability of alternatives for us to blend with our product is not necessarily available. We do not have a steady form of cellulosic available right now. There is not a commercially viable source that is, you know, there are some efforts, and we understand there are some plants, and we know that there are things being done, but we do not have a guaranteed source. We do not have alternative vehicles that are going to be used using electricity. So you're basically going to be basing a policy on a hope and a goal that it's going to be coming forward. We are not electricity. We cannot switch our crude supply to natural gas. We can't use wind. We can't use solar. You're talking about our feedstock, which is crude. Crude oil, that's our only feedstock. And before we start going forward, before we know what the alternatives are, we have to be very careful that we not destabilize not only a very important fuel source for the upper Midwest, but an important employer and an important economic development company, industry for the state of Minnesota. And that's why we're here today. We're happy to answer questions. We know that this is an emotional topic. We don't want it to be emotional. But I think that it's important that we have a full vetting of all of these issues and that we keep talking about this because we, as a company, understand the importance to the environment. We have done a lot as a company to try to come forward with a lot of voluntary environmental programs. We're happy to discuss those. But we also have to make sure, and we feel like we have an obligation as a company, to make sure you understand what kinds of problems these type of policies could create for our company as also for the state of Minnesota. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. I also have Jay Reinhardt here to answer questions as well.
Ms. Schmidt, do you agree with our state policy to reduce our carbon emissions by 80% by 2050? Do you see that as a worthy goal?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't know that our company has ever taken a position on that particular policy.
Ms. Schmidt, are you willing to work with us on moving this bill forward? And are there recommendations that you can make for how it can be more palatable for you?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, we are always happy to work with the legislature on proposals as they go forward. We believe right now that going forward with a low-carbon fuel standard this year would not be advisable. That doesn't mean that we don't think that there are things that could be done, both voluntarily as well as through legislation, to work on environmental programs. Whether it's through a low-carbon fuel standard or whether it's through some other programs, we'll be happy to continue to talk with the author as well as talk with members of your committee and other people in the environmental community. Whether it's a low-carbon fuel standard or something else, we're always happy to talk. We don't necessarily think that a low-carbon fuel standard is the answer.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, in listening, I wanted to make certain that I raise consciousness. I really think transparency is a critical point here, and that all fuels be treated fairly, which is the message that I'm hearing and the worry and concern that that won't happen. And also some discussion about concerns about others' intents about how to treat Canadian fuels. And I acknowledge that when you get out there and hear about it, you'll hear all sorts of things about how awful Canadian crude is and how awful ethanol is, and how, and what we're doing with this bill is requiring that all fuels be treated fairly and that the process for dealing with that is clear. And the second point I'd like to make is that we can't stop people from saying these things or making their arguments against various forms of fuel. But it is not the intent of this, and there's nothing in this language that treats tar sands differentially. And furthermore, I think what is important is that there is a process by which those improvements that were discussed within the plant, all of the investments that this company has made in improvements in terms of environmental things have occurred since 2005, which is the year baseline year, which means those values that are associated with that will contribute towards what they can say is an improvement in their number. And then finally, I don't want to bring up the Freedom to Breathe Act because I just don't want to bring it up, but I can tell you that when we, but I just want to make a correlation between that. In the discussions of that, oftentimes people said the Freedom to Breathe Act was about really trying to get rid of tobacco. And so these kinds of fears are always sort of present in the discussion about how we deal. That was not the focus or the intent of that piece of legislation. And it was clearly only about addressing the impact of secondhand smoke. This legislation is about reducing the carbon intensity in fuel production. That's what it's about, and that fuels be treated fairly across the board.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this is a question for you or for Mr. Seifert. On the, I heard there was two major refineries in the state. And is it if I'm correct, was that right? There's two in the state. And
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Flint Hills Resources, and there is also Marathon Refinery as well.
Okay. And were
I
they
would also mention that Murphy Oil is right across the border from me. So.
Were they invited to come to this hearing?
And everybody knows about it.
If they weren't, do we know? Is there a reason why they didn't want to attend? I'm assuming they're under the same restrictions then as Flint Hills would be. I'm wondering.
Well, the next speaker is from the Petroleum Marketers Association,
okay.
And they may be representing or talking
okay.
about the other refiners.
And the second question I had, Madam Chair, is for Senator Sharon, is on this the life cycle that we're looking at, all these costs or the carbon emissions that would be produced, and the credits that are going, you know, part of this. There's a supply chain to get that, you know, from the tar sands down to the tailpipe, as we're talking about. And all along that way, we can find a way to reduce the carbon emissions. Is that correct? And so in all the onus on solving this issue or addressing this isn't all on the refinery, is it? I mean, it's you can look at the whole supply chain to find a way to reduce those incrementally. So maybe in the first year, it's that another extraction method that you know, reduces the carbon emissions, and maybe the year after that it's a new type of blended fuel that comes online, and maybe there's another at some point or another refining technique that makes it a little better. Am I thinking correctly on what you your vision of how this would work?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Ms. Schmidt, is there an estimate how much this would cost the refinery to retrofit the facility to be ready for this low carbon?
Ms. Schmidt.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure it's really a matter of retrofitting. Because really, actually, at the refinery, there's nothing we can do at all to change the carbon intensity of our fuel itself. We've done most of the things we could do at the plant itself to reduce basically our carbon, say, footprint of our plant. So basically what we would have to do to meet a standard of this nature would be we'd have to change out our fuel, our crude oil. We would have to put a different type of fuel to blend with, which is we're talking about either an ethanol or cellulose, or we'd have to buy credits. And basically right now we would end up having to blend with something. We're not sure that we'd be able to blend enough to get to that 10%, and that's the problem, as you heard earlier. Even if we got to the 20%, that would only get us to 5% of the goal, which means we're 5%, which means then at that point, if the legislation is in place, we would have to stop selling gasoline. Okay, so that's important to know. And unless there was some other alternative that came into the market, which currently doesn't exist. And I'll let Mr. Reinhart, who is actually the expert, that's sort of my layperson's explanation, and I'll let him be more technical.
Mr. Reinhart.
Yes. Thank you, Madam.
And please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Jay Reinhart, Director of Operations with Flint Hills Resources. And really the technical question that you look at is, there are other specifications that are designed around whether it's ultra-low sulfur diesel, gasoline, all these different things that we have. And these specifications are put in place for the operability of the cars that we drive and the trucks that we drive. They're put in place for safety issues, whether it's how many VOCs and environmental issues, how much VOCs are coming off the gasoline. And if you look at those current specifications that exist for gasoline, ultra-low sulfur diesel, and other things, we technically do not have a way to reduce carbon without busting those specs, which are there for numerous reasons, mostly safety and operability of cars. And so when you look at that from our perspective, the cost then at the refinery isn't that we're going to put another low-carbon unit at the refinery. What we ultimately do is you end up losing market share on the way that's defined this way.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to say that my dad was a pipe fitter and worked on all the refineries in southern Wyoming. I'm from Colorado. And I just wanted to recognize and thank the gentleman in the back there. My question to you, Ms. Schmidt, is how many of the 850 employees are union, and what's the average pay? I mean, I'm sure it varies from electricians to the plumbers to the pipe fitters, whatever, but...
I don't have the exact numbers, but...
Madam Chair, I don't know if we have the exact number. I think it's...
I would say, as a rough estimate, three-quarters are probably union members, and that's not exact, but approximately that's probably amount that are union.
And Madam Chair, we are represented also by our contractors, which are a variety of building trades unions. So the contractors are almost all labor unions. It's a union facility. Our union on site is the Steelworkers Union. We also have the building trades, pipe fitters. We have the Carpenters Union, variety of different building trades.
Madam Chair, the reason I bring that
up is I
know that pipe fitters in this industry are much different than pipe fitters you're going to get out in other sectors. They are especially trained, and hopefully compensated for that.
Nope, nobody's talking about closing the industry down.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to recognize that because we are running out of time here, but I hope we can get to that.
And Madam Chair, just what a question.
Mr. Reinhart.
One thing to realize is that the way it's currently written and the way you look at it, you talk about not closing the industry down, but that actually reduces our what we work for. and so realizes that that's what this bill does, because we don't have the capability to reduce carbon.
We're looking forward to working with you on that language.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sanjam.
When you say that, it's just not technically possible, right? I mean, it's not that. I mean, even if you could afford it, it's not technically possible.
It has nothing to do with economics. Sorry.
But Mr. Reinhart, you're already having to blend fuel, are you not? You have to meet the 10% ethanol mandate,
mm-hmm.
and you know it's likely you're going to have to meet a 20% ethanol mandate. And so we move forward with a little progress toward a greener economy. Everybody's in favor of that, as far as I can see.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, let me explain a little bit, I think, what he's trying to say, which is that, yes, we already blend 10%, and yes, if the federal government gives a waiver to go to 20% ethanol, we will, of course, blend that. And, of course, we will be blending we are blending 2% biodiesel, and we will go to 5%, and, of course, we'll be compliant, and we'll do that. What we're saying is if you go to full implementation of this bill at 1% of year, and even if you go to the percentages that are in current state law, which are dependent on the federal government giving us a waiver to do that, and the auto manufacturers and others agreeing to warranty the vehicles to do that, that all being said, that only gets us to 5% of the goal. If there are no innovations that get us to the point where we can get to that other 5% over the next 10 years, we cannot meet the standards in this bill. We just can't. We can't meet it through, in our estimation, in the reading of the bill, we cannot get there, which means that you're putting us in a very precarious position as an industry that has to decide on our future investments going forward what we're going to do.
This is all part of a comprehensive plan that we passed in 2007 that is aimed at reducing our carbon emissions. The electric energy and the gas energy utilities also said, we can't do it, we can't do it. And I think as they come in over the next couple of weeks, we're going to hear that they've exceeded those expectations at this point. And I know that it feels to you that you can't meet them either. We're also hearing from Mr. Arnasty that there is research out there and that there is new technology on the brink of being brought into the market. So some of it we have to prepare to be ready to move forward.
Madam Chair, and members of the committee, one last point I would just like to make just for your consideration as a committee. We are a privately held company. We are not a regulated utility, which I think is something that needs to be considered as we go through the process. I mean, our business operates slightly different than that. That's one thing that makes us somewhat different than electric utilities. Another thing that makes us slightly different than the electric utilities as we go forward is the fact that we don't have any readily available current technologies for replacement fuels. As I mentioned earlier, we cannot switch crude oil to either natural gas, wind, solar, some of the options that are out there readily available in the market. We would have to be relying on science that has not yet been fully developed. And so I just offer that up for the committee to consider as you continue deliberations on this. So.
And I don't want to minimize the challenges, sure. And we're not trying to penalize your industry. It's just that we know that at the federal level they're talking about a low-carbon fuel standard. What are you going to do when that happens? At least we're preparing. You can have the advantage of being ahead of the game if we can come up with some solutions in Minnesota just prior to the rest of the nation turning.
Madam Chair, if I may. That one thing to also understand is when you compare sectors are different. And I think the real important thing to differentiate is, believe it or not, from a greenhouse gas perspective or a fuel switching perspective, the refining industry is rather clean. We're not starting from coal like the electric industry was, and then has all these options to go to natural gas, to go to wind, to go to other things that have significantly less carbon than electrics do. We're starting mostly around natural gas and in that area, so our capability to reduce from a fuel switching capability is significantly different than that of electrics. And so even though I do share the the amount of effort and great drive that has been done from an electricity perspective. Sectors are significantly different, and the refining sector is significantly different from that.
But you've admitted you can blend, and that there are opportunities out there to increase that blending. And it's a form of energy conservation where you decrease, you know, the fossil fuel and add on some of the renewable fuels.
Just, Madam Chair?
I'm asking all of us to keep an open mind and see if we can't work out a solution.
If I'm understanding what you guys are saying, it's not that maybe if you could blend to a E30, then you could maybe meet the carbon emission standards. But if you can only go to an E20, there's no way you can reduce the carbon enough by going to an E20. That's what
we
I'm understanding.
E85.
Well, E85 is different. I mean, because those are flex fuel vehicles that are designed for that. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've heard, we used to get that magazine from the ethanol folks. I don't get it anymore, I think, because of the industry's tumble. But they talked about blender pumps and all of those kinds of things. But because of the standard, is that what I'm hearing you saying, that at E20, you just can't get enough carbon out of the fuel, but maybe at E30 or something like that you could?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think there's a lot of unanswered questions. First of all, you're dependent on a waiver from the federal government. There's a lot of analysis that has to be done. You also have to look at the wells-to-wheel analysis that would have to be done on corn ethanol. You're also going to have to look to see if there's going to be enough availability of corn ethanol to be able to supply the percentage you would need. So there's going to have to be a lot of study with respect to what you would get to. But obviously, current availability and current rules and current laws would not allow us to blend at a level that would be able to meet the 10% in law right now. So that would be just a constraint on what we'd be able to do.
Well, it's obvious that we all have a lot to learn. Certainly I do, too. So I appreciate the discussion, and I'm hoping that we'll continue that. Senator Sharon, do you have some more comments?
Well, I was just wanting to put all that we've recently been talking about in a little context that we have talked about already, is that if the waiver, which would allow for us to legally blend at E20, is not achieved in the time frame, then we can accommodate to that in the bill. We're talking about 1% a year over a 10-year period, and that the E20, once that is passed, and we have an off-ramp regarding that, would allow the industry which to prepare to address that at 1% per year. It will be at least seven years before we move into the second portion of this legislation. So there's a significant amount of time in which these other processes will, and the investments we've made in these other processes for them to be developed. So I just want that placed in the context of that, rather than the panic as if all of this is going to be occurring immediately.
And we want to move forward with people educated and understanding how we can do this and not pushing it on people. So let's take a breath. And we'll work together to see, you know, how we can come to some solution about this. Senator Koch, did you have some comments?
Well, Madam Chair, if you would allow, I'd like to go back just a moment, Senator Sharon, and maybe the issue of higher cost. When I first looked at your bill, I said, this is going to be expensive. Just my instinct said this is going to be expensive. And when I looked at the arguments, the Isaac Walton League, I'm having a little trouble being convinced. Mr. Grant said, in our limited analysis, we don't believe that this would significantly increase cost. The arguments basically, well, there's a lot of factors that cause fuel prices to go up, so why are we going to worry about this one? That's a little bit like saying, there's a lot of things that make me gain weight, so if I'm eating cheeseburgers, I might as well eat chocolate. I should be mindful of everything that I'm eating if I'd like to lose weight. And in this economy, we must be mindful of every cost driver when it comes to fuel, when it comes to food. We have to be very aware of that in all the policy changes that we make. And I would also say that when we did the RES, we had a lot of off-ramps. We had a lot of consumer protection off-ramps. We said, well, if the cost will be prohibitive, then this. I don't see any consumer protection here, and I hear a lot of unknowns. And so, as you move forward with this, if you indeed intend to move forward with this, I would like to see a lot more emphasis on that, because Minnesotans are hurting, and we need to protect any increases in costs for anything, and especially with policies that we make. So, thank you.
Okay, we've already exceeded the time frame for our meeting today, and so I apologize for those of you who have not had a chance to testify, but we will continue this meeting next Tuesday and hope that you will come back and provide us with your insight at that time. So this meeting is adjourned.
Neither.